The difficulty of making sense of a God who is infinitely good, but who allows evil, is able to take things like suffering, like the murder of someone, and out of it to bring something beautiful. You know, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. So that's kind of at the heart of the conundrum that we're talking about when we talk about how does God allow suffering.
Our ultimate good is union with God. Christ is our union with God, so our union with God is our union with Christ. Christ was murdered. That's why many Christians were murdered. That's why Charlie Kirk was murdered, because his Lord was murdered. Suffering unites us with Christ. It's like welding. It's hot, it hurts, it's painful, but it unites us with our Lord and with his work, with his kingdom, which is in souls, which is salvation. So the martyrs are indeed the seed of the church. They're alive. A seed is an amazing thing. It generates new life, and you can't stop it.
Hey there, folks. Welcome to Socrates in the Studio, which falls under the rubric and sometimes also under the aegis of Socrates in the City. Some of you know about Socrates in the City, but what you might not know is that my guest today, and perhaps my guest today himself doesn't know, was instrumentally involved in my creation of Socrates in the City. I discovered my guest today, Dr. Peter Kraft, really in 1998. It was the centenary of the birth of C.S. Lewis, centenary being the 100th anniversary of the birth of C.S. Lewis. And I was privileged to go to Oxford and Cambridge to celebrate that. And while I was there, I was working for Chuck Colson at the time, and he was one of the main speakers, which is how I discovered it. And I was exposed to just a bevy of spectacular minds, thinkers, writers. I remember maybe the first day we were at the Sheldonian Theater, this glorious theater created by Christopher Wren in the 17th century. And I heard Thomas Howard speak. I had read his book, Chance or the Dance, and I was so thrilled to be there. It was just magnificent. And then the next day, I think it was the next day, the main speaker in the morning was Dr. Peter Kraft, and I had a similar experience. I thought, this is really wonderful, and this is related to what I want to do with the rest of my life. In years following, I read many of Dr. Kraft's books and was inspired finally in 2000 to start Socrates in the City, specifically because Dr. Kraft had written books about Jesus and Socrates. And so I wanted to be real clear about that out of the gate. I am very grateful for Dr. Kraft's work, and he has been a speaker at Socrates in the City many times, actually, over the years. But here he is now, Dr. Peter Kraft. Welcome to this episode of Socrates in the Studio.
Thank you, Eric, for the usual introduction that I can't possibly live up to.
It's all true, of course. And I should say, you've written so many books that you present this difficulty always of knowing where even to begin. So many wonderful books. But I wanted to talk to you today because you have written about Socrates and because you've written about Jesus. I've been thinking recently, because of the murder of my dear friend Charlie Kirk, about the role of truth tellers in a culture. There have been many over the years, but when I think of whether it's Joan of Arc or Bonhoeffer or Socrates or obviously Jesus, these are people that have caused trouble to the powers that be. And I thought it would be worth discussing with you the idea of what it is to be a truth teller and why it is that society, this wicked world, has so often tried to silence these truth tellers.
Yes. Well, the relation between the truth teller and the culture changes only because the culture changes. The truth teller doesn't change because truth doesn't change. the sun is always there. You can be out and get a nice tan if you use a little sunblock, or you can be out there and not get any sun at all if you're under an umbrella, or you can be out there unprotected and get sunburn. So our culture is moving into an anti-Christian direction. Therefore, it attacks people like Kirk. It didn't used to happen that way. But the message is the same.
Truth is truth. What was it? Because I'm always wanting to introduce people to my audience. What was it in your life? What is your biography that led you to be a professor of philosophy in Boston, where you live? What was the story of coming to faith? Would you tell us a little bit about that? When you were a young man, where were you theologically? Where were you in terms of what you wanted to do with your life? How did that change? Where did you start?
Well, my first instinctive reaction to that question is I don't need to answer it, because I just wrote an autobiography called From Calvinist to Catholic. So that's the more complete answer.
Well, that's all the more reason to talk about it, because we want people to buy the book From Calvinist to Catholic. But if you don't mind, tell us a little bit about that journey and how you grew up and what you were thinking earlier in life.
Well, Eric, I love you and you're a dear friend of mine, but that's the question I always fear. Summarize your book. What did you say in your book?
I didn't even know you wrote the book. Forget about it. What I'm trying to say is my audience, most of whom, of course, will not buy the book or read the book, but we're trying to whet their appetite.
I'll pretend I never wrote the book. I will forget the book. I can do that easily. I have ADD. I'm an absent-minded professor. So you ask me a question. Summarize your spiritual journey in about 2 minutes. I say, okay. I was born and brought up as a Calvinist, a good, honest, pious, God-fearing Calvinist like my parents. And I am immensely grateful to them and to the Reformed Church in America for introducing me to my Savior, Jesus Christ. And the reason I became a Catholic eventually at Calvin College, of all places, was that I came to the conclusion that my Lord established a single visible church, which he wants everybody to join as a historical fact. But the differences between Protestants and Catholics are minimal compared with the massive agreement. They have the same Lord.
That was not 2 minutes.
No, I like to keep it simple, stupid, because I'm stupid. So I do care.
I was going to give you 7 minutes, but no, I'm fascinated in people's stories, you know, and I know that most people listening to us right now will be unfamiliar with you. And this is why I get excited about talking to you, because I want people to be familiar with you and with your many, many books, tremendous, tremendous books. You spoke at Socrates in the City a few times, but twice I asked you to speak on, you know, how does a good God allow suffering? That's something, I believe you wrote a book with a title close to that.
Yeah, Making Sense Out of Suffering, yes. And my latest book, I think, which will come out soon, is a commentary on St. Faustina's diary, and that centers on the problem of suffering. She's a sort of a specialist in suffering, like many of the saints. This is certainly the strongest argument for atheism, and it needs to be answered. The answers that the church has always given are just summarized in my earlier book and in this one too. And the essential answer is that God deliberately allows us to suffer for the only possible reason he ever does anything, because he loves us. And he sees that it is necessary for our greatest joy in the end. And that's a matter of faith or trust. That can't be proved. That's why God doesn't explain anything to Job at the end, that classic book on suffering. You expect God at least to say, well, Job, let me explain to you. Let me let you read chapter one of my book. It's not the devil made me do it, but I did it for this reason, for that reason. He said, no. He just said, where were you when I made the world? Were you my advisor? Were you my script editor? No? Oh, well then, child, you just have to trust me. You can't possibly understand. And Job does. That's why he's a hero of faith.
Well, that's the thing. I think that if we know who God is, that's the trick. You have to know who you're dealing with. And if you know who he is...
What you know, it's who you know, right?
What's that?
It ain't what you know, it's who you know.
Right.
I'm told that was one of the slogans favored by the mafia. So the devil sometimes speaks the truth.
Well, this brings up... the situation with my dear friend Charlie, who was murdered. And I think that's a real test of faith. When a beautiful young person, a brilliant gift, such as Charlie was, is murdered, it really causes us to think about what do we make of that? What do we make of a God who allowed that? God is sovereign. What does that mean? I think we know that God does miracles. He miraculously saves people's lives. Many people like me are convinced that God miraculously saved Donald Trump's life from that assassin's bullet. And then you say, well, then why didn't God save Charlie's life? And that's the difficulty of making sense of a God who is infinitely good, but who allows evil in the world. And then Romans 8:28, of course, somehow is able to take things like suffering, like the murder of someone, and out of it to bring something beautiful. Of course, Tertullian said, you know, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. So that's kind of at the heart of the conundrum that we're talking about when we talk about how does God allow suffering.
Our ultimate good is union with God. Christ is our union with God, so our union with God is our union with Christ. Christ was murdered. That's why many Christians were murdered. That's why Charlie Kirk was murdered, because his Lord was murdered. St. Faustina says, amazingly, the two things that the angels would envy us of, if they could envy, are the privilege of Holy Communion and the gift of suffering. Suffering unites us with Christ. It's like welding. It's hot, it hurts, it's painful, but it unites us with our Lord and with his work, with his kingdom, which is in souls, which is salvation. So the martyrs are indeed the seed of the church. They're alive. A seed is an amazing thing. It generates new life, and you can't stop it.
I wanted to ask you about the story, of Socrates and of his, I don't know what you'd call it, not quite martyrdom, but the story of his demise.
Yeah, pure martyrdom, certainly.
He was
martyred for the truth. He didn't know God was the truth.
When Paul came to Athens,
he said, I see you are very religious, and he's talking about all the idols, all the false gods they worshipped. Then he picks out one, and he said, and I saw this altarpiece without a statue to the unknown God. And then he says something amazing. The God you are already worshipping, the Greek is the present progressive sense. You are already now worshipping in ignorance. I will now declare to you. So the God that Socrates sought but never found is the true God. Thus, Socrates is indeed a martyr, even though he didn't know God face to face.
Well, that's beautifully put. I've heard that. I think many years ago, when I first came to faith, I heard somebody say that I expect to see Socrates in heaven, and which is an interesting idea. What do you suppose was the difference between the God of Socrates and the God of Aristotle?
The God of Aristotle is a final cause, but not an efficient cause. He does not act in the universe. He does not love the universe. He's a snob. The God of Socrates is a mystery, not a snob, and he interferes with Socrates' life. He directed Socrates. He didn't just sit there and wait for Socrates to climb the mountain. We can't get to God, but God can get to us. And God got to Socrates as he got to some other pagans. I think of Lao Tzu. The Tao Te Ching has many echoes of the Sermon on the Mount. He got to them in anonymous ways. letter of the Hebrews says, God in many ways, in diverse ways, in times past, spoke to our fathers. And I don't think that means only the Jews. When Jesus told his audience that God did marvelous things in the lives of non-Jews, the Jews hated that. They thought they had an exclusive right to God. Not true. God loves everyone. Thus, Justin Martyr says Socrates was a Christian. And Erasmus says, St. Socrates, pray for us. There is, actually a St. Socrates in the Eastern Orthodox Church. It's someone named after Socrates.
I was not aware of that, that Justin Martyr had said that or Erasmus had said that. That's exciting news.
To die for the truth, even though you don't know the truth has a face, how could you know that except by the incarnation? To die for the truth is to be a martyr. Socrates was a martyr.
I mean, this brings up the question of people in our own day. I've noticed this a lot. People in our own day who would not describe themselves as Christians, they would be theologically ignorant, but they seem to have an innate sense of what is truth or what is right and wrong. And they seem to be willing to stand up for it, to sacrifice their careers for it, to sacrifice their lives for it. And so it seems to me a kind of the way the Kaler mean in A Horse and His Boy is worshiping Aslan without knowing Aslan, that these people somehow are worshiping the God of the Bible in how they live their lives.
Yes, yes. God claims that worship. Everything good comes from God and goes back to God, whether it's known or unknown. And everything evil, whether it's done by those who profess belief in God or by those who don't, everything evil directs you away from God. It's not the labels that make the difference. It's the reality that makes the difference.
But there are many people for whom the label is everything. And that's what I find so fascinating, that there are plenty of people that I know who would say, oh, no, unless you explicitly claim faith in Jesus, you cannot be saved. And I you know, the examples that you've brought up, it's different. But there are many people who get very upset about that idea. They seem to want to believe that there's just no possible way somebody like Socrates, for example, could be in heaven.
Well, Jesus himself refutes that when he says, seek and you shall find. Many people are in the process of seeking him. They have not yet found him, and they die in that state. According to Jesus' promise, they will find him. They'll get a theology lesson in heaven, and they'll find out that they were ignorant of the true God. But you don't get to heaven by passing a theology test. You get to heaven by faith, implicit or explicit.
Well, you're saying what I've at least tried to say many times. I think this is very important. And again, I think we're seeing a lot of it today because we've seen so much preposterousness, so much evil, that there are people that they have some innate sense of what is true and they're willing to stick their necks out for it. And I wish I saw more of that in the church than I do. I think that there are many people in the church who think, well, as long as I claim to believe this and this and this and this, I don't actually need to do anything about it, which I say proves that they don't actually believe this and this and this and this, and that there are people who are unaware of maybe what they would believe intellectually, or they couldn't put words, theological words, to what they believe, but they have a sense that some things are worth living for and dying for.
Well, here's an example for one of your own books. As a Catholic, I disagree with Martin Luther's theology, but I see him as something like a martyr. Those famous words, here I stand, I can do no otherwise, God help me. Those are the words of a martyr. He expected to be martyred. He got delivered by political forces that he didn't expect. But the motivation, the heart, the love is what moves us. And we are constantly making mistakes. God, nevertheless, is very patient with his severely brain damaged children. There's nobody who's got God in a box. There is truth and there is falsity. But the truth is what we can know about God is a thin slice of the real God. And people worship that thin slice that we can that they can know, their ideology or even their theology. They're idolaters. And idolatry always does harm. It's not just intellectual harm. It's not just a mistake. It has to harm their lives. Because idols all have the power of sucking the blood out of your soul. So if you worship your ideology, you can't at the same time worship God, the true God. Insofar as your ideology is your absolute and God is just an example of it, you're not worshiping God as God. You're worshiping your ideology as God.
I remember when I wrote my book on Martin Luther, I deliberately sent it to you because I wanted your opinion of it. I thought, I'm writing a book. This is not hagiography. This is simply history. And it's fascinating. It's at least fascinating history. And I was very moved that you thought well enough of the book to give me an endorsement for the book. And it's interesting to me that you now, as a devout Roman Catholic, are willing nonetheless to acknowledge the value of the life of Martin Luther. That's a rare thing.
Well, we're all mixed bags. Even the saints say they're great sinners, and many of the sinners think they're saints. And Luther was hardly a saint. There are aspects of his personality which are a bit, not just unsmooth around the edges, but kind of arrogant. But clearly, his fundamental intention was Christ himself. Christ was his Lord. And nothing can be more important than that.
But it's just interesting to me that you who are a Roman Catholic writer and thinker whom so many respect would go so far as to say that you think that Luther was a martyr. I mean, that's a bold statement. I think a lot of people would be troubled by that, maybe.
Well, Luther was certainly closer to the truth than Socrates. And if Socrates was a martyr, then all the more is someone like Luther a martyr. Martyrdom, you don't die for a thought, a theology, a system, an ideology. You die for a person. People often think that soldiers who risk death on battlefield are dying for an abstraction, America, freedom, democracy, equality. No, they're dying for the buddies. You die for a person. You can't sacrifice what is most precious for something what is less precious. And a person is the only thing God ever created that has intrinsic value. Everything else is for the sake of a person. God created the universe for us. God banged out the Big Bang for us. The universe is simply our long, big womb. And it's not going to last forever, and we are.
Bold in their determination to learn, in their resourcefulness to solve problems, and in their resilience to persevere. These are the marks of today's Christian leaders. Cornerstone students are not only tomorrow's leaders, they are today's Christian influencers, serving on the front lines of healthcare, business, ministry, and so much more. Boldly loving as they live into their calling. Boldly leading with wisdom and influence while forging new pathways in our world. And boldly living out their faith in Jesus Christ, our greatest influencer. Bold, Christ-centered, influential. We are Cornerstone University.
Because you've written so much about Socrates and philosophy, would you, for my audience who's unfamiliar with the demise of Socrates, talk about that, what it was that led to his trial and then to his subsequent death?
Like Jesus, Socrates was killed by a union of two forces, religious and political, and the religious was the fundamental force. The political laws of Athens said you have to profess belief in at least some of the gods that the state recognizes in order to be part of the state. And if not, you're not part of the state, you're not a citizen, and you can't live here, and you have to go out into exile. And Socrates couldn't, at his trial, honestly say, I believe at least in Zeus, or at least in Athena, or at least in somewhat one of the gods. He couldn't do that. But he kept speaking of the god in the singular and didn't name him. So because he couldn't profess honestly to believe in the gods of the state, he had to choose between exile and death. And as with Jesus, the Jews got the Romans in the person of Pontius Pilate to kill him for being an enemy of Caesar. And there's no Caesar in Athens, but the state itself was Caesar. That's why Jews and Christians were both persecuted in early Christian history by Rome and nobody else. Rome was very liberal, very tolerant, very open-minded. You could believe any god you wanted. You could believe in the special god of your tribe, as long as you professed that Caesar was Lord. And neither Jews nor Christians would say, no, Caesar is not Lord. God is Lord.
I did not know that. So what was it ultimately that led Socrates to death? I mean, and we were talking earlier, I mean, the theme ostensibly of our conversation is truth tellers and how the enemies of truth want to put truth tellers to death because they find the speaking of truth unbearable. How did it work out that Socrates, because it does seem that he didn't have to die. He sort of chose to die.
That doesn't mean he was a suicide any more than the fact that Jesus chose to die meant that he was a suicide. He was accused of two things. One, not believing in God's estate, and two, therefore being an enemy of the state by corrupting the youth. But the second charge was essentially related to the first one. How did he corrupt the youth? He taught a very traditional morality, a very high and holy morality. He served in the army heroically. He stood up to the 30 tyrants when democracy fell for a while. So he was not, in fact, an enemy of the state in any other way except religiously. So the people who got him killed were like the people who got Jesus killed. Their god was politics, and he was on the wrong side of politics, and therefore he died for that. And the religious charge was, for the state, simply an excuse. From the religious point of view, the political thing was an excuse, or rather a means, the power, the arm that executed the heresy that Socrates was guilty of. He did not believe in the false gods, the gods of the state. And he could have faked it, and he didn't, simply because he was honest.
It's an extraordinary thing, though, to think of somebody, you know, at the age of 70, being so courageous and so faithful to the truth that he is willing to die for what he believes in, because it would have been so easy for him in a way to say something, but he didn't think life worthy of living if he had to lie like that.
I think the deepest reason in Socrates' motivation is something rather mysterious. Most of us see truth as this kind of superficial thing, correctness, either political correctness, which isn't truth at all, or just commonsensical truth. The sky is blue, 2 and 2 are 4, we're living in Boston. He saw truth as something transcendental, something eternal, something intrinsically valuable, something worth dying for. It's not worth dying for the fact that 2 and 2 are 4, but it's worth dying if you think that there's eternity in truth. That's a divine attribute. And Socrates is always asking, what is something? He's trying to define terms. And he's never satisfied with ordinary definitions. He's looking for the eternal, changeless essence. What is justice? What is death? What is beauty? What is friendship? That very Platonic question, which gave rise to Plato's famous theory of forms or theory of eternal ideas, that was the sort of the backside of God that Socrates discovered, and he knew it was divine. It was worth dying for, because our life is only temporal and truth is eternal. It's not worth dying for something less than yourself, but truth is something more than yourself. It's not just an instrument of your brain to conform yourself to the world and get a little more happiness. It's something worth dying for. It's a divine attribute. And so is love. He didn't know about love being the supreme good. Maybe implicitly, something like that. Beauty, which is the object of love, is indeed one with the truth and the eternal there. So he came close to it. No, Socrates is much closer to Christianity than Aristotle, which is why the church fathers loved Plato, and why when Aristotle's works were rediscovered, Aquinas said, well, on a lot of issues, important philosophical issues, Aristotle was right and Plato was wrong. He became rather unpopular.
Interesting. I often wonder whether in the intellectual climate of Jesus's time, whether Jesus might have been aware of some of the Greek philosophers such as Socrates. I don't have any sense of that.
I don't either. The consciousness of Christ, God incarnate, is a great mystery. On the one hand, he himself says that the Father has not revealed certain things to him, for instance, when the world will end. On the other hand, he certainly has supernatural knowledge that we don't have. So the data are so thin that there's a lot of room for speculation there.
Because you've recently written this spiritual memoir, From Calvinist to Catholic, I wanted to ask why you hadn't done so before now, because it seems central to your life, to your story, or have you written some versions of it in the past before this one?
A very short article. I don't like autobiographies. I have no problem with biographies, but autobiographies are inevitably skewered by the fact that we don't see ourselves as others see us. That's why C.S. Lewis didn't want to write an autobiography. And he says on the first page of his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, that he thinks autobiographies are sort of like diaries, wastes of time. And that book itself is more an autobiography of Joy than of Lewis himself. There's a lot of things about Lewis that you don't learn there. But what's more important than his personality and his particular road is the eternal things. What is joy and how do we relate to it? So this book of mine is, I think, intended to be like that of Socrates. It's not about Peter Crafe so much as it is about Calvinism and Catholicism and our way towards God.
Was there a moment for you, you said you were at Calvin College, when you began to think about these, or was there a particular moment when you were awakened to the idea that there's more to life than Calvinism?
Well, I gradually fell in love with things Catholic and thought they were temptations and investigated them. And the more I investigated them, the more respect I came to have for them. Especially for the saints. I think saints are the point of the arrow, and their theology and their works and their morality are the wood of the arrow. But the first thing that attracts us, even if we're skeptics, is the saints. You can't meet a saint and not be impressed. So I was gradually coming to believe that Catholics were right on each of the controversial points, but I was still hesitating. I'm a thinker and therefore a natural skeptic. And this was an important question and I wanted to be sure. And I suspected that maybe I would never be sure. And then one day I had a kind of imaginative vision. I was fully awake. This is not something supernatural. Here was Noah's Ark, and it was big, and all the saints were on it. My favorite ones, Augustine, Aquinas, Justin Martyr, all of them, with the animals. And it was a zoo. It was a messy thing. And here I was making the same trip as the Ark in a little lifeboat, a spiffy little lifeboat, only 500 years old. And I was going to get to heaven too, but I was in the wake of the Ark. And the Ark was the single church that Christ founded. And I saw the saints waving to me, "Come aboard." And I couldn't give any reason not to, so I did.
I grew up in the Greek Orthodox Church. What are your feelings toward the Greek Orthodox Church, or toward the Eastern Orthodox Church, I should say? Do you see it as equal to the Roman Catholic Church, or an ark by the side? How do you think of it?
Are men and women equal? Well, they're not the same. They're equally necessary. They're equally precious. But I certainly believe in the superiority of men to women in masculine things, and equally in the superiority of women to men in feminine things. I think each side of the church needs the other. Pope, our two great popes, John Paul II and Benedict XIV, both used images like, here are the two lungs of the church, or the two wings of a bird. We need each other. There are issues that divide us, but they're not fundamental issues. How much authority does the Pope have? How universal is that authority? That's a serious difference. And the filioque, is that a permissible, or is it necessary, or is it wrong? That's an important theological issue. But beyond that, our creeds are the same. Our sacraments are the same. The difference between a Roman Catholic and an Eastern Orthodox is far greater than the difference between either of them and a Western Protestant. The things that we agree about between East and West are things that have lasted for thousands of years. So when John Paul became Pope, someone asked him in an informal interview, what are your three highest hopes that you can achieve as a Pope? And he mentioned three things. He said, well, my highest hope is to significantly get closer to reunion with the East. And secondly, I want to save the world from communism. And third, I want to clear up the mess in America. Well, one out of three ain't bad. You know, he and Reagan and Thatcher did a pretty good job on communism.
Yeah. Well, I guess this brings up the question for a lot of people. The biggest stumbling block to Catholicism in recent years was the papacy of Pope Francis. And I always want to ask my particularly faithful Catholic friends, how do you reconcile Pope Francis's papacy with your Roman Catholic faith? I'm always confused by this.
I think Francis was a genuinely holy man. I don't think he was somebody who had a plot to destroy the church or to fundamentally change its unchangeable dogmas. But he sailed pretty close to the edge. He was definitely a liberal rather than a conservative. And he wasn't brilliant. I think he made some mistakes. Popes have made mistakes. Popes have made more serious mistakes than Francis ever made, and even came closer to heresy. He was not a John Paul, but I don't think he was a hell-inspired demon or someone whose plan was to wreck the church, as many on the far right believe. Which is why I think Leo is the Holy Spirit's choice to get back to the center and end that horrible polarization between the extreme right and the extreme left, which has infected the church from our politics.
Yeah, well, that's a whole other conversation. Whenever I'm around you, I want to ask you every theological question in the book, just because it's fun to talk to you about theological things. The other day, I had a guest on my program who said that there's a Christian leader, Bill Johnson, who I think in a book said that Jesus laid aside his divinity while he was here on earth. And I didn't really have a problem with that statement. It seems right to me, but she was troubled by it and thought it to be heretical. What is your view of that? Or can you say anything about that? Whether Jesus laid aside his divinity while he was on earth?
It's a mistake. It's a category mistake. He laid aside something. The kenosis is real. He laid aside his divine privileges. He laid aside his ability to immediately access all of the mind of the Father. He grew up as a human being. He didn't know the Hebrew language when he was 1 week old. He had to learn it. So that's the great mystery, that his divine nature, which is unchangeable, can't come and go. Yet the use of that nature can come and go. It's a bit analogous to our own situation where we have the ability to do things in principle, but not in practice. For instance, can a four-year-old solve quadratic equations? No, not unless he's a genius. But does he have the mind that, under proper conditions and training, years later, can do it? Yes. So he has reason, even though he's not exercising reason. Here, a one-year-old, or let's say a one-week-old, cannot perform a rational act, cannot commit a sin. Reason and free will haven't clicked in yet. Yet that being is a rational animal. He's already rational. He's got a rational soul.
Mm.
But it's not working yet. And eventually it will. You can't teach monkeys to do equations. Only human beings. So the difference between the behavior of, let's say, a six-month-old chimpanzee and a six-month-old human being is not that different. In fact, in many ways, the chimpanzee is smarter than the human being at 6 months. And yet what that human being already is something much more exalted than the chimpanzee. He has an immortal soul, a relationship with God, and reason. So he's already got reason. So at every point, Jesus has divinity.
Yes. So then that statement is incorrect, that he laid his divinity aside. He laid aside aspects of his divinity, but not his divinity.
No, not aspects of it. No. All the properties of the divine nature are one. For instance, justice and mercy are the same thing in God. So properties don't change any more than the essence changes. The use of his divinity, the access to divine knowledge, that's what he laid aside.
Okay.
It was there.
Yeah. Very important distinction. I'm so glad I thought to ask you that, because I was confused by it. Well, we just have a few moments left, but since the topic we began on was the idea of truth tellers and why many of the greatest of them have been silenced. And again, I think of my sweet friend, Charlie Kirk. I should ask you, because you're a philosopher, I wouldn't do this to anyone else, but let me ask you the ultimate question, or at least it's among the ultimate questions, which of course Pontius Pilate infamously mentioned in front of Jesus, who was himself truth. When somebody says, "What is truth?" What can we say to them? I mean, you and I would say Jesus is truth, but in a more expansive way, what do we mean by truth when we speak of truth?
When someone asks, "What is truth?" they may be asking one of three different questions. Number one, give me a correct philosophical definition. Number two, who knows what truth is anyway? I don't want to directly say it, but I don't think anybody can know the truth. Truth schmuth. The third is, truth seems to be a mystery. There's something that has to be real about it, and we've got to have access to it. On the other hand, it always recedes from us. How can I get there? How can I find the truth? That's the most important question. The very first thing Jesus asks his disciples in John's gospel, the very first words out of his mouth are, what do you seek? What do you want? What do you love? If you love the truth, you'll find it eventually. But only if you love it. In the seventh chapter of John's gospel, the Pharisees are asking him, how can we understand your teaching? And you say it comes from God, whom you call your Father. How can we know that's true? And he answers both questions in an amazingly simple way. He said, if your will were to do the will of my Father, you would understand my teaching and that it is from him. The will is the captain. The mind is the navigator. They're both equal. They're both in touch with eternity. But the navigator has to obey the captain. And the captain can command the navigator to shut up and put your charts away. I don't want to see them. I think that's the unforgivable sin. The deliberate not wanting to know the truth. The deliberate choice of darkness over light. Yes, God is God and he has rights over my life and I understand that and I hate it. Well, if you hate it, then you're going to hate heaven. If God took you to heaven, it would be hell for you. Like the dwarfs in the last battle. They're in the presence of God and then they're darkness because their eyes are closed. They don't want the light.
I forgot about that. But of course, I think of the Great Divorce, very similar thing. And what an extraordinary thing that Lewis gives us. He gives us ways to imagine these things that I don't, apart from him, I can't think of anybody. When you talk about...
He's the new Dante. He's the simplified Divine Comedy. That's the Great Divorce.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, of course, that's right. Well, it really is it's fun to speak with you, Dr. Kraft. I'm so grateful for your work. And I really do mean it, that Socrates in the City, whether you know it or not, or are willing to acknowledge it or not, was in great part inspired as a concept because of you. So I want to thank you for that. And thanks for being with us today for this discussion. Very much appreciate you. Thank you.
Well, I hope that you and Socrates and the City both have a long and happy life. God bless you and your work.
If you think these conversations are valuable, would you do us a favor and please like this video and subscribe to this channel? When you do that, you help us get these conversations out to a wider audience by telling YouTube that people are interested in this. Also, you can go to SocratesInTheCity.com, sign up for our newsletter, and you can check back every week. There's new stuff here every week. Thank you for tuning in.